All right, so I'm going to present some work that I've been doing in collaboration with Nava Rubin at the Center for Neural Science. And during this work, I've profited from helpful conversations with Anita Disney, who's a graduate student at the Center for Neural Science, Davi Geiger, who does computer vision at the Kront Institute, Dave McLaughlin, who's a general applied mathematician, and Bob Shapley, who does experiments in the early primate visual cortex. And this was supported by an NSF grant. So the talk is partly, well, I'm sure everyone knows what the figure ground problem is and what the border ownership problem is. So the border ownership problem, so first of all, I should apologize because this talk, I'm used to giving it to mathematicians, so I may be explaining things that everybody already knows, in which case, just tell me to shut up. Okay, so the border ownership problem is the fact that when you project from a three-dimensional world onto a two-dimensional surface, you're going to introduce edges. The projection on the two-dimensional surface is going to have edges that weren't there originally in the three-dimensional world. So if you were looking at a white ball on a black background, then this is what the projection would look like. You have a black field surrounding this white disk region. Ignore the red annuli. And in this case, you've introduced this edge, the circle. But this is the exact same projection you would have if you had looked at a black piece of wood with a hole in it in front of a white background. So in both cases, you have the exact same edges in the image. But the difference is that if you are looking at a white ball on a black background, the edge belongs to the disk. And if you're looking at a black piece of wood with a hole drilled out of it, the edges belong to the black. So whenever you have an edge which is caused by an occlusion, then there's going to be an ambiguity what the edge belongs to. And if you look at the famous optical illusion by Rubin, where you have the two faces, it's a black and white illusion, and you either see two faces looking at each other or you see a vase, when that percept flips, you actually feel the edges change allegiance. I mean, the edges actually are bound to the figure. So this is called the border ownership problem, which is that whenever you have an edge, there's an ambiguity what the edge belongs to. And there's that ambiguity whether you're looking at something like this, which most people would say, well, that's clearly a white disk on a black background. So there's always the ambiguity whether or not the image itself is ambiguous. Here, the image is ambiguous. This is a bistable image, and the percept alternates between the figure being these white things on a black background, or the figure being these black banister-like things on the white background. So here, what is perceived as figure alternates in time. You can also force yourself to change the percept. This is actually an interesting illusion because the Gestalt psychologists originally argued that given an image, there's a bias towards the symmetric thing being the figure. So here, the black regions are symmetric, whereas the white regions are not symmetric. And the Gestalt psychologist said that when there's an ambiguity, things will break in the direction of the symmetric. So people should perceive the black regions as figure more frequently than they would perceive the white regions as figure. But in fact, people actually perceive the white regions as figure. It's bistable, but like 55% of the time they see the white regions as figure. And this actually demonstrates that convexity, the fact that these are sort of blob-like, convexity trumps symmetry. But in any case, you have this ambiguity, what the edge belongs to, whether or not the image is perceptually bistable or is perceptually stable. So that's the border ownership problem. The figure ground problem in general, you have that global shape attributes affect figure ground perception. So here, people perceive black bars as figure on a white background. Here they perceive white bars on a black background. So here the figure is clearly tied to which has the smallest area, right? Here the smallest area is black, so that's the figure. Here the smallest area is white, that's the figure. Here, these are bistable images. They're 50% black, 50% white. And in this case, the percept alternates, but it spends slightly more time in this being the figure, the white being the figure. Here, the percept alternates, but it spends slightly more time with the black being the figure. And this is a similar illusion. These are due to Kanisa, And again, here, it's 50% black, 50% white. But this case, the white, which is symmetric, is actually beaten by the black, which is more convex. So these are not convex in the mathematical definition, but they're certainly more blob-like.
You say that you spend more time on the white, but the black are symmetric, so...
Right, that's the thing that's interesting. So it was originally thought that symmetric was the most important. And then it turns out that convex is actually slightly more important than symmetric. So these things, they're more blob-like. And so you could think of some sort of ecological argument about, you know, in nature, you know, we have symmetry in faces and things, but if you're out walking in the woods, the leaves are you know, convex. When leaves overlap, you might have cusps and things, but it's not clear that symmetry would be necessarily the be-all and end-all. But until the late 1970s, it really was believed that, you know, first you have area, and then when it's 50-50, then you would go for symmetry. And here, this demonstrated that even if it's 50-50, that convexity can beat symmetry. And this is exactly the same thing. Convexity beats symmetry, but these are bistable. You just spend slightly more time seeing this as figure and seeing that as figure. But the point is that global shape attributes affect the percept. It's not like you can just look at a small part of the image and say what's going to be perceived as figure. You have to know area, to know symmetry, to know convexity, those are global attributes. And so that's the point of this transparency. And then there's one transparency which is especially cute. This is by an artist called Shepard. So what's the figure in the top? What color is the figure?
White
is the figure in the top and black is the figure in the bottom. Yeah. So here.
Oh yeah.
Here, white is figure. And here. Black is figure. And this is just really demonstrating, you know, this thing, these are more convex, these are more blob-like than that. Also, cusps turn out to have a strong signal. Cusps belong usually to the background. Another demonstration, and cusps can actually totally trump area effects. Here's a demonstration of that. What do you see?
Is it legitimate that you never see a ground or a figure?
No. Well, I mean, yes, it is. I mean, you don't necessarily have to see a figure or a ground. But a lot of people see the white as being the figure here. And they see, like, raindrops or some sort of goo coming out of a toothpaste tube. So this thing is actually... this shows how important corners and cusps are, because this is actually 87% white, which, if it was just area effects, would say that black should be the figure. Okay, so that's the psychological problem. And so what Nava and I were interested in is whether you could write down a model which could be computed in V1 or V2, which would explain these global effects, like the symmetry and the convexity and the area effect. So first of all, let me, we got started on the model quite a bit before this experimental paper came out, but there was a paper that came out in the Journal of Neuroscience in 2000 from Vonderheit's group. And so Vonderheit has done quite a bit of work on things like this. So the thing that's, all right, well, let me just explain the experiment. So first, they find a neuron in V1, V2, or V4, and they find its classical receptive field. So they take a bar, and they flash it around the screen, and they find where the neuron will respond to. And they find that the neuron responds to bars that are in this region of the screen. So once they have found the preferred angle of the neuron and they have found the classical receptive field, they build force stimuli. They also find the, you know, whether the neuron has binocular preferences or color preferences and that type of thing. But once they have found the preferred orientation of the neuron and the classical receptive field, they then make force stimuli. So these stimuli are of light gray squares and dark gray backgrounds, dark gray squares and light gray backgrounds. And you can see that you've got all four possible permutations. These are monkeys. These two stimuli, if you're looking in the classical receptive field, they have identical stimulation within the classical receptive field, dark gray to the right, light gray to the left. Same with these two. If you look within the classical receptive field, these two stimuli are identical, dark gray to the left, right gray to the right. These two stimuli, you have the figure is to the left, and these two stimuli, you have that the figure is to the right. And they actually did these experiments both with this type of stimulation as well as with random dot stereograms, because with the random dot stereograms, there is no ambiguity. The dots that are closer are in the figure, the dots that are further away are in the background. Here you could worry whether the monkey is seeing a dark gray square on a light gray background, or whether the monkey is seeing a dark, you know, a light gray piece of wood with a square cut out of it in front of a dark gray background. Because this is, it's unclear what really would be perceived as the figure if you repeat these experiments with random dot stereograms, which would disambiguate and make this the figure, then you get the same results. So the point is that you have this neuron that whose classical receptive field is quite small, and yet they find that the neuron can tell the difference between these four stimuli. So if the neuron responds to A and C, then that means that the neuron is paying attention to where the figure is. If it responded to B and D, that would mean the neuron is looking at where the figure is. If it responds to A and B, that means the neuron is looking at the local contrast polarity. If it responds to C and D, it looks at the local contrast polarity. So the thing that's very confusing about this is that what you're doing is you're somehow getting global effects, right? I mean, you've got the classical receptive field, and yet the neuron seems to be knowing about what's going on elsewhere. Stimuli, this is different from work by Lamet and Zipser and Rossi. They've looked at stimuli where instead of positioning the classical receptive field at the edge of the figure, they position the classical receptive field inside of the figure, and they ask, does the neuron know whether it's inside of a figure or outside of a figure? Here, it's on the edge of a figure, and it's more which direction is the figure. So this would be sort of, if the neuron fires, then it would be, you could say, well, okay. So that's the stimuli. Let me show you the results. So this is a zone V1. So the experiment is that the animal fixates at the cross, and at the cross, there's a little stimulus with a bar. So the fixation arrives, the animal pulls down a lever, and inside of the fixation, there's like a vertical line. When the fixation goes horizontal, the animal let goes of the lever. So the animal is fixating between half a second and 5 seconds while this cell is being measuring. So the animal is awake, the animal is awake and behaving, it's fixating on a point, and you're measuring from a cell whose receptive field is away from the fixation point, and they vary the fixation time. Okay, so here they found, so this is the spikes per second, and they found that this animal, this cell, responded very strongly to figures A, to images A and B, and less weakly to images C and D. So because it was responding strongly to A and B, that indicates that this cell was sensitive for the contrast polarity, dark gray to the right, light gray to the left.
This is complex or simple?
They didn't measure. They're edge sensitive, they're not end stopped. This is V1. So their measurements were V1, V2, and V4, and I'll give a breakdown at the end of the presentation of the experiments. That's what I would think.
I mean, just because apparently it's very hard to find non-conflicts when you wait to get one.
So here's a cell in V2, and same paradigm. This time you're actually seeing the raster, the spike rasters, and the reason that they're different lengths is because they were different attention times. And here you see that the cell is responding more strongly to images A and C than to B and D. So this cell is seems to be coding the border ownership. It seems to be responding if the figure is to the left. The animal is looking at a solid, a blank screen. Then when the fixation signal comes on, the image also comes on in the peripheral. So they're looking at a screen of equiluminance, and then a fixation point comes up simultaneously with this, and when the fixation point goes off, it goes equiluminance again. Time zero is when the fixation goes on, I think.
It doesn't seem to be a transient that they usually get.
Right, so it goes from the fixation has a vertical and then it goes to horizontal, and that's when the monkey knows to let go of the lever. Just signals whether the monkey's paying attention.
And the time there is a second, right?
Yeah, so it was half a second to 5 seconds, although this one goes to 8 seconds for some reason.
Are they the same two tops? There's more going on than the bottom?
Yes.
So that's evident
in the
basketball.
Yes. I think it's hard to see the transient here because it's such a long time scale. There are
bizarre.
What?
Yes.
I think that there is a transient in the beginning. You probably lose it here just because it's usually around the first 200 milliseconds or so. But you see it go up and down. And,
right. So they, know, they.
My high resolution is not good enough to see 200 milliseconds.
Right. This is not. This is. They, in the article, they do actually do the time traces, and they compare the time trace when the signal is not there and when the signal is there, and they do get differential. They get time data. I didn't actually present those transparencies. I didn't Xerox those transparencies, but they did do a transient time study. So they've got studies where they look at the first 200 milliseconds after the stimulus is turned on, and they find that if you look in the first 200 milliseconds, then there's a marked difference in these two cases from the first 200 milliseconds of these two. And they, they actually were sort of a little bit crude in how they analyzed the time traces, but they did some very gross ensemble averaging. But basically, they found that the difference between these two is recognized in the first 25 milliseconds. So within 25 milliseconds, this time trace, the time trace in response to those images, will be different from the time trace, the voltage trace to those.
First 25 milliseconds.
Very fast.
25 milliseconds, things don't even get to the cortex.
If you look, you have two time traces. So actually, so you have two time traces of the voltage. So it goes up like this. And if they look at the half height, they find, so this is when
it is a transient,
and they find that the time gap on the half height is around 25 milliseconds. And this is out to 200 milliseconds.
Okay,
so this is the response to the thing that it didn't like. And this is the response to the thing that it did like. And so first of all, there's going to be a response in both cases because it's an orientation.
So what you can actually see here is the thing is clear in first, however, you know, until the second line, there is no big difference.
There is no big difference for the... Exactly.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's 25 milliseconds suggests that it's not coming from MT or something. So basically, it's sufficiently short that it's reasonable to suspect that it's happening
well,
with
25 millisecond signal onset. There's a 25 millisecond
difference
between the half height, which could come. We don't know what the time from zero is. It could come after 200 milliseconds. We don't know what the time is between, right? We don't know what the time is from where you started to on the graph.
Yeah. So this time was between 45 and 60 milliseconds to here. So 25 milliseconds. So they gave a window between 10 and 25 milliseconds, but the way they got those numbers were somewhat crude. So you are right that, you know, things can come very quickly from MT. So, but basically, what their time trace studies showed was that it is a very quick. There's a very quick distinction. Okay, then this is a cell that coded for both the border ownership, so the direction of the figure, and the local contrast polarity. This was in V2. And then they found cells that just didn't care at all. But here's the breakdown. So they had 61 cells in V1, and what you want to know is the horizontal lines, which are ownership, and the lattice, which is ownership and contrast. And so you find that 18% of the cells in V1 can code for border ownership. You find that 15 plus 44, 59% of the cells in V2 code for border ownership. And in V4, you have 38 plus 15, which is 53%. Sorry, V4, 53% code for the direction of the figure. So they found these quite early. These experiments haven't been reproduced, but the article is pretty tight. But I should point out that these things are very wide open because this type of stimuli is not especially well understood, and like the experiments of Lamé are still, you know, Lamé and Zipser and Rossi have been going after these figure cells for quite a while, for much longer than this. So, anyway.
These different types of cells, do they cluster in some way, or maybe there's a continuum?
You mean topographically in the...
No, in these response properties. Here is not clear from this video whether they establish a criterion for the response to ownership.
Right. Right. They had a way of coding the degree to which it responded to the direction of the figure and the degree to which they had the contrast. And so they actually do it for each cell. They assign it, you know, how good it is at responding to the direction of figure, how good it is at responding at the direction of contrast. And they found, again, it's in the article, I didn't do the transparency, they found that in V4 cells are really quite modal. I mean, they're either very good at responding at figure or very good at responding at the direction of the contrast. In V1, they're sort of, you have more ambivalent cells that are, you know, 60% good at responding to the direction of the figure. Okay, so basically, what we wanted to do was we wanted to write down a model that could do that could possibly be in the early visual, computed early using local receptive fields. And so the model is a variant of a model by Pau, Geiger, and Rubin, which is somewhat similar to a model by Kummerer, Geiger, and Gurvitz. And it's based on the concept, it's based on self-conscious edges. So edges have opinions or biases towards, this edge would have a bias towards whether the figure is above it or below it. So we start with an image, and we compute many possible segmentations of the image, and then we select the one or two that have the lowest cost or the highest goodness. And hopefully, the goal is that the lowest cost segmentations will be the ones that are observed perceptually. So first, I should say what a possible segmentation is. So if you're given an image, which is just a matrix of pixel intensities, so we did black and white images, Gesundheit, then the possible segmentation is a matrix of probabilities. So at each point in the matrix, you have a number, and that number is the probability that the ijth neuron is in the foreground. So if P is a matrix which is just made up of zeros and ones, then every unit is either highly probable of being in the foreground or highly probable of being in the background. If the entries in the matrix are 1/2, then the units don't know, are equiprobable of being in the foreground or in the background. So we try to go from an image to an assignment of probabilities at units. And so you should imagine that the units are, you know, like you've got a topographical representation and that the units are within that. So,
zero means like the background.
Right. So if. So if this was the image, then the matrix, then the ideal output would be a matrix which had one at units which get input from this point in the screen, and one at units which get input from that point at the screen. One, that's the figure. And here, this is the background. The units that get input from this part of the screen should have zero. This is the background. Units that get input from that part of the screen should get zero. Over here, units that get input from that part of the screen should have p equals 1 because they're in the figure. And units that get input from this part of the screen should have p equals 0 because they're in the background.
But when you watch this, the whole figure, vertical line,
right.
Vertical column, either in the figure or in the background. In the whole figure.
Right.
What you're trying to do is moving your eyes, and you are in your model based on fixation.
Right. So we don't want eye movement. So you are right. I mean, these things are really, you get confused by attention, by where you're looking.
So the model will just give one unique answer. You will not describe.
So the model will give all possible answers, but two of them should be. So with this image, let me show another one. If the model, if you were given this image right here, the model will give two outputs. One will be 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0, corresponding to these puppies being the figure. The other output will be 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1, corresponding to the blacks being the figure. And the model also will have a way of measuring the goodness of those two outputs, because we can perceive either of these, but we perceive the whites as being figures slightly more frequently. So the model will have a way of comparing the two outputs and seeing. So you start with an image, and the first thing the model does is you find the edges in the image. So here's the image. The dashed lines are the edges in the image. You place some apertures along the edges. So you can imagine these are receptive fields that have been activated because there's an edge at the preferred orientation running through them. And so the idea is that this cell, the cell where this is its receptive field, it a priori doesn't know about those cells. This is all it knows about. And so if it's capable of coding which direction is the figure, it would just make a random guess. So this cell would guess that the figure is down and to the right. This cell would guess that the figure is down and to the left. This cell would guess that the figure is down and to the right. And this cell would make the guess that the figure is up and to the right. So each cell is just going to flip a coin and make a first guess at where the figure is. So the way that's coded is I had blue for the direction.
we just assign 1 to these values, 0 to those values, and 1/2 elsewhere. So we start with the first guess, and clearly if this is what the 4 cells thought, they're not going to, that's not consistent with that interpretation, because this cell is in disagreement. This cell thinks the figure is outside, these 3 cells think the figure is inside. So if this was the first guess of these 4 cells, then they're going down the wrong track. But since there's no reason for them to know about each other, we allow them to make this first guess, and we find out what that means. So we call this set of first guesses a local hypothesis. So each one has made a guess where the figure is. And if there are n apertures, then there are 2 to the n possible first guesses. So this is horrifying, right? You've got, you know, 4 apertures, so you've got 2 to the 4th possible things to consider. 2 of them are good. 1 is going to be where they all think the figure is inside, and 1 of them is going to be that they all think the figure is outside. So 2 out of the 2 to the n will be consistent with possible percepts, and the remaining will result in gibberish. But we consider this because they don't really know about each other. So this is just a model. So given the first guess, you then propagate that first guess to the other cells in the network, and you find out what that would mean. So the way we propagate that information into the network is through minimizing an energy. And there are 2 terms in the energy. 1 is a smoothness term. So neighboring units should have relatively close P's, where they're... Which?
PIJs are...
Oh, PIJs are the output probabilities, so they can be anything between 0 and 1. So they can be a third. So this is requesting smoothness with a cost function. So if this is 0, then the neighbors can disagree. The unit ij and the unit I prime j prime can disagree. If this is large, then there's a very strong bias for them to be close. If this is medium sized, then there's a stronger bias for them to be close.
The n is something you choose?
Yes. So I'll get into that in a sec. And this is a fidelity term. This is asking that each unit remain faithful to its first guess. So if the output is far from the first guess, then this will be a large number. And this is a fidelity weight. So if nu is large, then there's a high cost for infidelity. If nu is small, there's a low cost for infidelity.
The n and nu are negative and positive?
They're all positive.
All positive.
So the nu,
you
freeze the first guess, and then you find the p that minimizes this. The mu's and nu's are not part of...
If you didn't freeze the first guess, you have a very trivial answer, which happens to be 0.
Right, but we do freeze the first guess. So the fidelity, we demand high fidelity inside of an aperture and low fidelity outside. And let me just show you the result of the computation so that this seems less opaque. And then I'll talk a little bit about the mu. So here, this is the image. These are 3 initial local hypotheses. This one is consistent for the figure being inside, consistent with the figure being outside. This one is gibberish. We minimize that energy, which basically corresponds to diffusing the biases towards the rest of the network.
Don't you have units all over?
We do. So the units that are not, these units are given an initial guess of 1/2. So this unit doesn't have an opinion, and the fidelity to its, so this unit is initially ambivalent, and it has a slight bias towards ambivalence. It's not going to be completely swayed by the information coming from those apertures. So you see here.
And the circles you give is many.
Yes. Yes. So here you see that there's that this center is not as white as that edge. Here you see that this out here is not as black as here. There's sort of you increase in blackness as you move here, you increase in whiteness as you move here. That's because there's an attenuation. There was that fidelity term where there's this fidelity term which kept this unit slightly loyal to its initial guess of 1/2. So if you didn't have, if you only required fidelity inside of the apertures, then this would be solid white, this would be solid black, this would be completely 1, this would be completely 0. Whereas if you do have some fidelity towards the initial ambivalence, then the figural signal actually decays as you move towards the center, and the background signal decays as you move out. And so with these three initial local hypotheses, you diffuse, you propagate the information, and this one is all of the units that are greater than 1/2 are figural units. So this one suggests that the inside is the figure. Here, all of the units that are greater than 1/2 are out here. They suggest that the outside is the figure. Here, when you look at all of the units that are greater than 1/2, that have probability greater than 1/2 of being in the figure, you get something like this. So clearly, this is not the percept. When people are shown this image, they never respond to percept like that. So this is basically encoding the fact that there's a conflict, that this and this are in conflict with each other. And mathematically, what this means is that the black is a value of 0, the white is a value of 1. You have a smooth function. If it goes between 0 and 1, it has to equal 1/2 somewhere in between. When you have a conflict like this, you're always going to have regions where you have values of 1/2, values of 1/2, values of 1/2. If you look at this versus this, there's a lot more gray in here. So we're going to use that to select these two out from things like this. So I won't actually, let me skip how the coefficients are chosen. That's what I'm going to say right now. But so the cost is going to be that we want to penalize things that are ambivalent. So we want to look at if you're given, if this is the output, then these units in here are very close to 1. These units are slightly less close to 1. Those units are slightly less close than 1. But if you look at the actual values at the units, you get, 0.99, 0.95, 0.9. And here you get, 0.1, 0.2. So the values here are pretty close to 0 or pretty close to 1. So all of the units are pretty close, pretty probable of being a figure or pretty probable of being in background. Similarly here, whereas here there are a lot of units that have values near 0.5. So our cost is going to try to penalize things that have values close to 0.5. So the cost function is going to penalize ambivalence.
You say that you start from all possible P0?
Right, so we start from all possible P0, which cannot possibly be what the brain is doing, we think. Unless there's some sample bias towards only selecting some initial local hypotheses, you can't really expect that the brain is doing an exponential search, storing all of the outputs, comparing all of their costs. Well, for something simple like that, you don't have to. But for something more complicated, you would. So I'll show you an example later. So for the cost, what we do is we measure their entropy. So we just, at each unit, we evaluate p log p. And then we add it up over the units that think they're in the figure. So the point is that if p is 1, then this is 0. And if p is 1/2, then this is 1. So what we're doing is we're just adding up a function which is 0 whenever p is 1. So if a unit is strongly confident it's in the figure, it's going to have 0 contribution to this cost. If the unit is ambivalent, it's going to have a large contribution to this. So this is going to be a measure of the goodness of the output. So if the proposed segmentation is made up of only zeros and ones, so if everything is very, everything is purely, is either, probability 1 of being in the figure or probability 1 of being in the background, then the goodness or the entropy is 0 because you're just adding up a bunch of zeros. And if all of the units are 1/2, then this goodness or entropy will be 1. So this is just a way of adding up, you know, all of the values for each unit that is probable of being in the figure. We count whether it's p is 0.55 or whether it's p is 0.95. Yes?
Is there a special meaning to taking
p log p?
P log p, because anything that could be
yeah.
Number of
p. Yeah. No, there's nothing special. Okay, so if we go back to the computation right here, and you measure, you apply that goodness measure, then you find that this one had that the entropy is quite low, 0.34. These things are really quite close to the value 1. Here, the goodness measure is pretty high because there's a lot of grayness coming from the borders, which has partly to do with boundary conditions, which I can talk about later. But this one, the entropy is higher because although these units are greater than 0.5, they're more in the 0.6 range than in the 0.9 range. And here, the entropy is higher still. So that's
just. Did you just add that p log p to the
class? Right, so that's the two-stage model. So I'll talk about that in a sec. If you look at a histogram of entropy values, so here there were 12 apertures, so there were 2 to the 12th initial first guesses, so you do 2 to the 12th minimizations and you compute the entropies, then, and you do a histogram, then this is what that histogram looks like. You have one sitting all the way down here, you have some here. Those, let me explain what those are. But that's what it would look like if you look at all 2 to the 12th. And the red is the one where the disk is the figure. The green is where half of the units think the figure's inside, half think the figure's outside. The black is where only one unit is in disagreement. And then the rest are the gibberish first guesses. So there's a strong separation of that one, and then the next best are if only one is in disagreement. But, okay, so let me then show. Okay, so then there's the question of how does this behave when you actually ask the questions about the effect of size, the effect of convexity, perceptual bistability. So for size, we took a collection of images where the area varied. So here the white bars are figure, white bars are still figure. Now it's 50-50 and it's bistable. Here the black bars are figure and the black bars are figure. So we applied the model to a family of images. And we found, so here, if you take that the if the image is only 1%, 10% white, and you assume that the white areas are figure, you get a very low entropy. If you assume that the black areas are figure, you get a very high entropy. And as the area fraction of white increases, then the difference between those two interpretations gets smaller until there's an overlap. So here the error bars are because the apertures are placed randomly. And so you place apertures 10 times, do 10 computations, and you measure the entropies. So this demonstrates that the area effects.
This is because you broke the symmetry by putting only bigger pixels.
So here. Yes. Yes, then you couldn't tell the difference. Right, then you couldn't tell the difference because the energy that you're minimizing is 0-1 symmetric. The entropy is 0-1 symmetric.
So where do you choose the
entropy? So what we do is we take the image, we put it into the computer. The computer finds the edges, and then it just randomly places apertures.
Always
place the apertures on the edges. And for that simulation that I showed you, we knew what the answer was ahead of time, so we always assigned the apertures to be consistent. The p right. So if the initial entropy we looked at, you would symmetrize at about 1/2, and then. So the entropy that I gave isn't 0-1 symmetric, but since I cut off, you're right. Yes.
I thought you may have chosen the variation from the entropy precisely.
No. Yeah. No. So like 6 months ago, we actually were using the p log p entropy, but we had symmetrized it. And so we don't. Right, because there's that intent. There's that. Right, exactly. So there's the attenuation. So this unit, if it was in the figure, it would be out of luck because it's so far from the figure signal that it would have lost a lot of. Right, so is there any justification for the attenuation? Well, so this is something, so this I don't really understand, but there are very definite differences between figure and background are not psychophysically equivalent. When you do experiments on humans and we're much less affected by changes in the background than we are to changes in the foreground. I mean, we have different responses to background and to foreground, and so it's not unreasonable to separate them in a model. But this, I mean, I'd have to refer to Kafka or Rubin. I mean, we really do respond differently to background and figure. But so basically the area effect is exactly as Misha pointed out. Here, these units are in the figure, and since they're close to the edges, there's going to be less attenuation. If you flip this in your mind and you made these black and white, and this unit was trying to be in the figure, there would be a lot more attenuation, and its figure probability would be lower. So the area effect is due to the attenuation, and the convexity effect is actually also due to the attenuation. Here, if you look at, so here I've done just a cartoon of, if you have an aperture here and an aperture here and an aperture here and they're propagating their signals, then the attenuation is coded by this ring being lighter than this ring, and this ring is lighter than this ring. So the attenuation is coded by the fact that these are decreasing, these are getting darker as you move out. And if you take two units, one here and one here, a unit in here gets much more reinforcement from its from those apertures than a unit the same distance out here. So this is there are earlier models where the model of Finkel and Saita, for example, they just coded this in a priori. They would look at a point on an edge, they would look at the convexity, and if the edge was convex in this direction, they would say the direction of figure was in this way. If the edge was convex in the other direction, they would just a priori say that the direction of figure was in that way. So this is trying to get the convexity effect without actually coding it in ahead of time. So the point is that the attenuation of the signal gives you the convexity effect because this unit here is getting, things are focusing in on it. Whereas if you looked at a unit out here, it would be getting a strong signal from these two, but the signal from these two would be very attenuated. So convexity effects come from the attenuation. And if you look at here we looked at perceptually bistable images. So here are three local hypotheses, one with the yellow being figure, one with the blue being figure, one is gibberish. These are the results of the minimization. And the entropies, you have that these two have markedly lower figural entropies than this one. So before, when I showed you the entropies, there wasn't such a large gap between these two and something like this. Here, there really is a large gap between these two interpretations and something like that. So that's a code, that is a signal, a symptom of the bias stability, that both of these are pretty good. If you took this to be, you know, if you took yellow to be figure, you'd get a pretty good answer. If you took blue to be figure, you'd get a pretty good answer. And then if you compare the two, you find that this has a slightly lower entropy than that, which is consistent with the yellow being figure slightly more often than the blue. So the point is that the functional sort of captures convexity effects, it captures area effects, it captures enclosedness effects, and so it actually seems to be able to disentangle those two slightly. So here the thing is, this is a very simple image in that the luminance boundaries actually correspond with boundaries between figure and background. A more complicated case would be something like this. This is a variant of something found by Rubin. So here you have an image where there's an interleaving. And when people look at this, what they see as the figure is they actually see these two blobs as the figure. So what's interesting here is that the luminance boundaries are not figural boundaries, because this is a luminance boundary, but it's not a figural boundary. And right here, there's a figural boundary, but there's no luminance boundary. So a question is how the model would behave on something like this. So here we place the apertures on all of the luminance boundaries, and we asked what would happen if you did something like, say, let's take the yellow is figure. So wherever there was yellow, we biased that towards being figure. Here we put apertures on all of the edges, and we chose an assignment which would make the blobs the figure. Here we put apertures on all of the boundaries except the spurious boundaries, and we chose them so that the blobs would be the figure. And so these are three very special initial choices, and these are the results of the minimization. Here this is saying that the figure is the yellow region. Here this is saying that the blobs are the figure, and that also some of the stuff up here and the stuff down here is figure. This one, you get only that the blobs are figure because we didn't put apertures on those. This is a bit of a cheat because we've violated the code. We came ahead of, we decided ourselves to ignore those edges in the image. But when you compute the entropies, you get that the entropies decrease, that this has a higher entropy than this, and this has a higher entropy than that. So, and the other thing is that when you look at this, this solution has a figural boundary in the neck. And it has a figural boundary here, even though there was no luminance boundary, and it has no figural boundary here. The cheating paid off. Okay, so then what I just presented is a two-stage model. So the first stage is you find the interpretation from the first guess. And since there are many first guesses, there are many interpretations to consider. And from the many interpretations, you find an optimal one. And so this was an energy minimization, and then this one was a goodness measure. And so the issue is that, you know, there are 2 to the n possible interpretations. So one thing is that maybe it isn't a uniform probability. Maybe the apertures end up more on, you know, maybe the apertures tend to only show up on cusps or on corners, and in that case they tend to be not uniformly, you know, probability 1/2 of being inside or probability 1/2 being outside. So one possibility is that the location of the apertures would only show up on, you know, salient parts of the image, or that they would be biased by other things, or that you don't sample uniformly. Another possibility is to do a one-stage computation where you try to do both of these at once. And so here you would be doing something like minimizing a free energy, where you minimize the energy and the entropy simultaneously. So here you would get something which is the same energy, plus you would include a cost for deviation from 0 and 1. And then you have to minimize this. So you now, since both the first guess and the segmentation are free, you have to minimize over both of these quantities. This is the term that penalizes the apertures from being away from 0 or 1. So you would minimize this free energy. And here's an example computation. This is the input image. You make a first guess at what the solution is. You make a first guess at where the apertures are and what their directions are. And then you take these first guesses and you use them in the minimization routine, and you find an output which has the inside as figure and the outside as background. And this aperture has flipped its bias. So these go towards these. So this is work in progress. The concerns, well, I have many concerns about this work, but one of the concerns that I have is that it's not clear what role energy minimization has in these things. I mean, it's energy minimization arguments have been around for quite a while, right? I mean, Poggio and Marr had them in the mid-70s for binocular rivalry. And so the argument was that, you know, you try to minimize the energy, so that's an iterative process, and you take a few steps in trying to minimize the energy, and then you look to see how, you know, and then you stop. And so it's a question of how quickly the iterative process converges. And if you don't get close to a reasonable answer until you've had 50 iterations, then it's a pretty dubious approach. If you get close to an answer when you have 5 iterations, then it seems plausible. And so what we really desperately need is the time stuff that I was talking about, the 25 milliseconds in the Shou von der Heydt article, was not found in a particularly responsible manner. What they did was they took all of the cells that liked figure on the left, they averaged their time traces, and then they compared their time traces to when the figure was on the right. And so they just sort of did an ensemble average across, like, you know, 100 different cells. They averaged the time traces of 100 different cells and then compared them. So they didn't actually have comparisons of within a particular cell. They had comparisons across a class. So we don't know how reliable that 25 milliseconds is. And also they didn't do the time analysis for depending on the size of the figure. So if this something like this is legitimate, then the larger the figure, the longer it will take to resolve. And they didn't do anything like that. We would really like something like that. If it took longer to resolve a larger figure, that would be consistent with an iterative model. But it's not completely impossible. I mean, here we have a model which would be, you know, completely within V2, say, done by feedback, lateral connections within V2. And depending on the size of the receptive fields, it could be possible to get something like this to converge in like 5 iterations. But the experimental data isn't out there. So this is very speculative. Anyway, that's it.
So I don't quite see how these generalize the situation that you have.
Right. So you can certainly generalize the model to do layers of figures. So it's not a problem within the model. I mean, I could change the energy function so that there would be layers, and one figure would be in the top layer, and the next thing would be in the right, and sort of peeling it off. So the model can certainly be generalized to do occlusion. The Finkel and Saita in 92, their model also did multiple layers, using something somewhat like this, but not, well, they didn't give enough information really to say precisely what it was, but. Yes. Right, so then the question is whether, I mean, here. Yeah, here our edges are very well defined. But the thing is that, like, it is true that if you make very small manipulations in a figure, they show up. So, I mean, a classic example is if you look at, so if you take a Kinesa figure, Kinesa square, so you have that the image is sorry, what? Yes, I got it in the right direction. So the image is four white Pac-Men, and the percept is that you see a black square on four white disks, and that this region in here is actually blacker than this region out here. So the percept, when you look at this puppy, is that you actually see edges here, and that this is blacker than this. And if they measure from cells in V1, whose receptive fields are right here, those cells are happily firing away as if there really was an edge. Now, if you take this image and you put a small gray disk here, then you show it to the person, they still see those edges, but this edge is gone. And if you move that little gray disk, then there's some distance at which that edge reappears. And so very small manipulations in the image are having an effect on the percept. And if you ask where small manipulations can be seen, that's V1, V2. So, I mean, it's not completely ludicrous to think that part of the segmentation problem could be done early, and that harder things.
I'm still perplexed with the data that's shown in the beginning, experimental results. I know it's not yours, and you probably have a limited amount of, but to start with, they choose edge detectors.
Yes.
Things that respond to the edge, and they flash this this box or whatever it is on this receptive field of the cell where it should respond to the edge.
Yes.
And then some of these cells don't respond to the edge.
Yes.
Right? Because they only respond to whether it's inside the figure or outside of the figure.
Right. So
that's what's kind of perplexing.
Right. So the question is whether there's actually inhibition when the figure is on the wrong side. So I can't remember if they gave the firing rate for an edge, a plain old edge, as opposed to. So they did take larger and larger figures and found that the difference got smaller as the figure got larger. So if you imagine the figure getting larger and larger, at some point that square is going to be very much like an edge. And so they found that the.
So testing it with the school field edge.
Right.
So the thing was changed, not in making a smaller size of the edge, kind of changed it.
So I've got the article, and I've read it in the past. I reread it in the past week, so I could look at it again. But they were careful not to exclude end-stop cells. But
now, presumably, according to your model, cells that are inside the figure, should not just on the edges, should also respond. And in all orientations, should also respond.
Right, so our model, if you were going to do it physiologically, would be something like a combination between the cells that Zhu has have found, the ones that are on the edge, and cells that respond when they're in the figure, like Lame. So it's because we have units that aren't anywhere near the edge, which think that they're in the figure. One thing that's sort of interesting in the Zhu article is they actually looked at stimuli which were like this. Things like this, where it wasn't just a square. And they still found that if the cell preferred something like this, it also was happy with a figure like that. So they actually looked at some fairly complicated figures. We didn't. I mean, the closest connection we came with, I mean, the only thing we have is basically the, you know, the comparisons of the entropies, you know, that you have. I can't put that up. We don't have any real connection to data.
I mean, so you try to think about how you implement your principle in your own model.
Right. Yeah, so if I wanted to connect it to data, then I would give a time scale to a single iteration in the minimization, and I would ask, you know, if I have only 5 iterations, how well resolved is the figure? If I have 10 iterations, so the iterations would be the iteration time would be more like the time course for the connections between cells. So how for each iteration, if you have a line of cells and you have input here, in one iteration this cell will know about it, in 2 iterations these 2 would know about it, and in 3 iterations all 3 would know about it. So it's a question of how long it would take one cell to influence its neighbor. And so if you were to allow the system 5 iterations, how well resolved would the figure be? And so the number of iterations you would allow could come from experimental data. Another thing that would be a question would be the size of the receptive field. So if you have a large receptive field, then you would require fewer iterations. I mean, you have an image that's this big. If your receptive field is like that, then in 4 iterations, these 2 would know about each other. And in 2 iterations, this would know. If you have a small receptive field, then it would take many more iterations before a unit in the middle could know about information from here. So there's sort of two things that we would need to know would be receptive field size and some time scale for how long it would take this to affect this. And then those 2 could give us some sort of timing on the model. And so then once we knew that timing, we would ask, well, how far can you have gotten in 25 milliseconds? So maybe in 25 milliseconds, this is the furthest you've gotten, and this is the only region that you're confident is figure. Maybe in 25 milliseconds, the information's gotten further. But I mean, that's the type of thing that we would be looking at for physiological. Also, it would be interesting to know if there is more bias from units here at corners and at cusps. But yeah. Exactly. So if you write down the PDE that the minimization corresponds to, it's a heat equation. You have sources and you have diffusion, and the final thing is a minimization. It's a stable solution. So everything's converging towards it. It's a question of how far you've gotten towards your fixed point. You have some fixed point, and you have your first guess, and you're stepping towards the fixed point. But how close have you gotten to the fixed point in 4 iterations?